Okay, welcome. So the idea here is to get from Mount Sinai to whatever is being published today in terms of the history of halacha. Obviously, that's going to be a little bit too much to digest in any short amount of time, even in a 20-25-part lecture series, but the goal is to at least gain familiarity with the major works, with the contours of the development of the history, and to try to understand what's the dynamism of the history, meaning what changes and what doesn't change, in what sense is there continuity, and in what sense is there discontinuity. So if you look at the Jewish library, it's structured like a pyramid. Right? When we start from the beginning, there's not that much material, and as we go along, there's more and more material, right? The material that's been produced more recently is just voluminous in comparison to what was just a few generations ago, and that was voluminous in comparison to what came before it. So there's a pyramid, right? We're at the base of the pyramid. Well, I guess it depends on... Okay.
At the bottom supporting the top.
I guess it depends on the perspective, meaning we're reading, when we're learning for the most part from what's at the bottom. And we don't even know how that gets, you know, we're trying to understand how is that, I guess, logically, it's pyramid, I guess, whatever, perspective. Okay, whatever. So one of the questions is this spin an even distribution? Meaning, is this like blowing up a balloon, right? That as time goes on, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Or was there some sort of punctuated equilibrium? Was there some sort of, were there certain time periods where there's an explosion of creativity and of productivity as opposed to, meaning in comparison with the other side, with other times? And is there a history even to production, right? There's some production, which is an attempt to summarize, right? To take everything that came before and let's try to...
codify.
Yeah, let's try to codify it. Let's try to put it in a form that's going to be easy to understand. And there are other times that you see there's more creativity, chidushim, new things... things that weren't part of the canon before. They seem to come out of left field. And the key question is, does everything ultimately go back to the Torah Shebichtav, to that, or even to Sinai? Or are there other sources of law? Are there things that seem to come from somewhere else, some other time? Okay? And another key question is, where does halacha live? What's the locus of halacha? Is halacha something that exists in books? Or is halacha something that exists in practice, and what Jews do? Right? Is halacha what the books tell us to do? Or is halacha what God-fearing Jews do? And if there's a relationship between those two elements, what's the relationship? I'm going to... turn on the air conditioner. Okay. That's not here.
Just turn the on button.
That's okay. We'll go. Okay. Music. Okay. So those are some of the questions that we're gonna be looking at as we develop. The first topic that I want to address is the topic of periodization. Okay, halacha, we think of halacha. Halacha has been thought of for more than 2,000 years in terms of distinct periods. What I mean by that is not just that there's, you know, like we say that we're in the modern era and before that was early modernity in the medieval era. No, there's a nafkamina. There are implications to what period you're from. If we're in the time period of the Achronim, part of what makes the Achronim is that they don't argue on Rishonim, and part of what makes Rishonim is that they've accepted the Talmud Bavli as being canon, right? You wouldn't disagree with the Bavli, and part of what makes the Amoraim is that they won't disagree with Tanaim. They won't disagree with what it says in the Mishnah. Okay? So if we think about that, the entire, if we think about this period, this period is this pyramid structure, right? That's how it's stacked, right? It's stacked at Achronim on top, you know, on top of or underneath Rishonim, and so on. And there's a basic question when it comes to periodization. Right, when we say that an Achron doesn't argue with a Rishon, does that mean that he's not allowed to argue with a Rishon? Or does that mean he simply wouldn't argue with the Rishon?
What are the years of Achron and Rishon?
We'll get there, but for basic context, it's easy to think of these things in terms of like 500-year periods. Right, the last 500 years since around 1500 has been the period of the Achronim. 500 years before that is the period of the Rishonim. The 500 years before that is this fuzzy period of Savorayim and Stamayim and Geonim, meaning the Bavli was finished and becomes the book. And then the 500 years before that is the Tanaim and Amoraim. So 200 years for Tanaim, 300, 400 years for Amoraim. That's the basic. Right? And we're talking about these things start to develop around the time of the last generation or two of Bayit Sheni.
There was before the Tanaim also.
Yeah, well, tonight we're going to discuss what was before the Tanaim.
Elliot?
Yeah. So I think that one of the things that modern historians, that contemporary historians are looking at is that there was this myth that was created in the 1800s, this myth that before the Enlightenment, the world was in the Dark Ages. Right? They even called certain eras the Dark Ages. That medieval times was nasty and barbaric and brutish. And I think that, I'm not an expert in music, but I think that there was a lot of development that was going on that we generally don't think about. Meaning that the modern era, certainly there were things that changed from before modernity to modernity, but that those changes were not as discontinuous as people in the modern milieu.
The rate of change in the arts is accelerated tremendously.
Okay. Well, something to think about. Okay, I want to get back to ancient history before we discuss the modern era.
Question hanging. Can an Achron argue with a Rishon?
Can an Achron argue with a Rishon? Okay. And a related question is, who says when one period ends and another period begins?
He can argue, but he can't full rank. It's still, there's precedence that he has to overcome
okay.
with something from a different
source. So, the way that I understand periodization, and we're going to look at some sources now to see if, if this is borne out. The way that I understand periodization is that, first of all, there is no moment in which one period ends and the next one begins, right? There's all kinds of arguments over when does, what event ends the period of the Rishonim and begins the period of the Achronim. And some will say, oh, it's the publication of the Shulchan Aruch. And some will say, no, it's the invention of the printing press. And some will say, no, it's the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, which, one's in 1455, 1492, and then I think 1536. Whenever it is, right? Shulchan Aruch is published. And the truth of the matter is that it doesn't exist. There is no moment, right? What constitutes a period is that at the end, at a certain point, people look back retrospectively and say, wow, the world is very different than what it was 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, right? We experience this to a degree today, right? We think of the world that our parents or grandparents came from, the world I think most of us are from Eastern Europe. I know that Ron's family has been in Baltimore for like 30 generations, but for most of us, like, we're the children of, or children, grandchildren, or great-grandchildren of immigrants from Europe to the United States. And we look at that European existence as something that we don't have access to. It. We feel distant from it. We can't overcome, there's a historical chasm there because there were momentous events that interrupted that history. And now we're on the other side looking back and we feel distant. So I think that you have something like that, let's say, going on from the transition from the Rishonim to the Achronim. I don't know when exactly there was a transition. I don't know if there wasn't a moment, but in the 1500s, when the two main Jewish centers in the world were the Ottoman Empire and the Polish and the Kingdom of Poland, and they're looking back at the works that were written mainly in North Africa and France and Germany and Spain, they're experiencing distance. So in their own consciousness, they're looking back and they're saying, that was a different era. That was a different time. Right? They don't think of the bygone era in the same way. Right? And sometimes you can have, where, I'm living somewhere and I'm living in a certain place, and I feel a very strong continuity going back several centuries. Right? The Jews in Spain in the 1300s might have felt very connected to the Jews in Spain in the 1100s or in the 1000s, but once you get to the year 1500 and there are no more Jews in Spain and they're looking back at the old country and they just don't feel like they're part of the same, they feel like something has changed. Right? They feel that there's been too much turbulence, too much disruption, that they don't feel continuous with the past. And when you experience a break with the past, a discontinuity with the past, then the past, in a certain sense, becomes sacred. The past becomes something that we can't possibly argue with them because they're everything we have, we're inheriting from them, right? That world ceased to be, and we're trying to import that world into our world. And in order to do that, we have to accept it. We have to accept it as it is, meaning it becomes tradition. It becomes it closes an era.
So what you're saying is that eras end not chronologically, but culturally.
Correct. Meaning it is chronological also because it happens in time, in history, but there's no rule of how, how long a period can last.
Theoretically, you could argue that the dividing line of the Shoah. Europe and
I think it remains to be seen. I think that you did have to a very
coincides with Medina, which would put an end to the Arab or the Arab countries that had Gedolei that disappeared as well.
But I think that it's going to be another couple hundred years before people will be able to look back and say that, oh yeah, there was a shift there. You don't really notice it in real time. And in every transit, in every time there's a seam, there are transitional figures, right? So we think of, let's say, Rav and Rabbi Yochanan in the Gemara, right? Where the Gemara will often say, Rav Tanahu Upalig, Rabbi Yochanan Tanahu Upalig. They're the first generation of Amoraim. They didn't experience that rupture, and so they feel comfortable arguing with Tanoim. You have it between the Rishonim and the Achronim. You have it with, let's say, the Maharik or with the Maharshal, sages, Rabbanim, who lived in the 1400s and the 1500s, who they didn't feel that there was this sort of rupture. Maharshal was like, okay, yeah, I can argue with the Ritva, I can argue with the Ran, I can argue with the Rambam. And at the same time, you have Achronim arguing with him. So let's go back to the beginning.
Was this dynamic not felt at all in Jewry that was agnostic to Europe, so such as Jewry in the Middle East and Lebanon, Media, Iraq, and Syria?
In terms of what? In terms of today?
In terms of this, Rishonim Achronim dynamic.
So the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, that's...
Right. So that's why I say agnostic of Europe. I mean, that's Spartan, but
Yeah, it's still European, right? We don't like to think of Spartan as being Europe.
Right.
You know, even in the Balkans is also Europe.
Correct.
But, I mean, the most continuous, we're going to discuss that a little bit when we talk about the transition from the Geonim to the Rishonim. Okay, that sense of, if anything, it was the Iraqi Jewish community that had the longest sense of, we've been here continuously forever. Until 19,
so is there
until
no,
the early 1950s.
Is there no Rishonim Achronim period in that culture, per se?
That's an interesting question.
No,
there's, you know, we'll get to that. Meaning, we'll get to, meaning they do have...
Beni Shchai.
Right. The Beni Shchai is what I was thinking of. We'll talk about the Beni Shchai, but that's... Okay. All right. Let's start from the beginning. Mishnah, first Mishnah in Avos, should be familiar. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, misara liYoshua, Yoshua lezakenim, zakenim leNeviim, Neviim masrua laAnche Knesset haGdola. Okay, there's a little bit more of an expansive version of this in Avot Rabbi Natan. So, whenever I introduce a book, a work, I'll say a little bit about it. The Mishnah, okay, the Mishnah is compiled, we'll say around the year 200. Okay, the Mishnah was an edited version, a compiled version of teachings that had been circulating in various schools of, you know, in various rabbinic academies for the generations prior, and the Mishnah itself is a layered text. Right, the Mishnah itself, there are some parts of the Mishnah that are earlier, some parts of the Mishnah that are later, and there's an entire discipline of studying the formation of the Mishnah. In addition to the Mishnayot, there are things that were left out of the Mishnah. Right, there were teachings that were left out of the Mishnah. Those are baraitot, and the word baraita literally means left out. Right, it means outside. Some of these were in collections, and some of them were sort of like free radicals that were just kind of floating around. So you have, for example, the major collections. There's the Tosefta, which is very similar to the Mishnah in structure, meaning in terms of its layout, in terms of its table of contents, even though it's much larger than the Mishnah. And the nature of the relationship between the Mishnah and the Tosefta is also, it's the subject of a lot of discussion. It's an expansion of the Mishnah. It's a little bit later than the Mishnah, but again, there are parts of it that are earlier than the Mishnah, that there seems to have been a process of expansion and contraction going on for a while before the Mishnah was put in its final form. Why was the Mishnah put in its final form? Well, it wasn't really. What I mean by that is that every school, every academy, every circle that gathered around different rabbanim, different rabbis in those first centuries, they had their own curriculum. The Mishnah that we have, that was the curriculum that was studied in Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's academy. One of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's students, Rav, moved at some point to Bavel. And he taught according to Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi's curriculum. So that became the curriculum in Bavel. Right? There wasn't... One of the things that we're going to see is that a lot of times things that we perceive as these momentous moments in Jewish history, the Mishnah is put into its form, is... I wouldn't call it accidental, meaning Rebbe did edit and compile a Mishnah that he used as his curriculum, meaning that they would recite, meaning these were texts that were transmitted orally, but the reason that it became the Mishnah with the definite article was somewhat accidental. There were other Mishnahs. Okay?
He was in Eretz Yisrael.
He was in Eretz Yisrael, yeah.
Until it was accepted, probably about 1,500 years.
Yeah, but in Bovell, it was the only show in town,
right.
Or it was the main show in town.
When Rav came there.
When Rav came there, which was in the generation after Rebbe.
But it was not there, had they filmed,
Rebbe is the end of the time. Rebbe is a generation and a half before. I'm sorry, Rebbe Meir is a generation and a half before Rebbe. Right, Rebbe is in the generation. Rebbe Meir is in the generation after. After the failed Bar Kokhba revolution, okay, so it's in about the mid 100s. Yes, Rebbe talks about how he saw when he was a child. He saw the back of Rebbe Meir's head, right? So they did overlap, but that's why I say they're about a generation and a half apart. And yes, we had Stam Mishnah Rebbe Meir means that Rebbe was using the earlier Mishnah of Rebbe Meir, that Rebbe Meir is anonymous because Rebbe Meir is the speaker. Right? Rebbe Meir doesn't quote Rebbe Meir. Rebbe Meir quotes others. Okay, so Avot Rebbe Natan is a Beraita on Avot, right? So it's a little bit more expansive than Avot, and you'll see that it's a lot of times it's, you can see how the Mishnah of Avot is distilled from, or how the Braita in Avot Derabbi Natan is an expansion of the Mishnah. So here you have Yehoshua Kibel Mi Moshe. So here he does it. They do the reverse. It's not Masrel Yehoshua. It's Yehoshua received it from Moshe. Shnei Amar, and it brings a proof text. Benatatam Yehodcha Alav Laman Yishmu Kol Adat Yisrael. Zekenim kiblu mi Yehoshua. Zekenim got it from Yehoshua. Shnei Amar v'yavdu ha'am et Hashem kol yimei Yehoshua v'kol yimei ha'zekenim asher ha'erichu yamim acharei Yehoshua asher ra'u et kol ma'asei Hashem ha'gadol asher asa li Yisrael. So when did these Zekenim live? Right after Yehoshua, but who were the Zekenim? Meaning how long did the period of the Zekenim last? Not very long. These were the people who were around in Rabbi Yehoshua's time. They came in with Yehoshua. They came in with Yehoshua. They saw all the things that God did for the Bnei Israel. But they were, they died relatively soon. And then it says, Shoftim Kiblumi Yehoshua. So now they Avot to Rabbi Natan introduces the Shoftim into the calculus. We don't have that in the Mishnah. No, it mentions the Zekenim. They're the Zekenim of Sefer Yehoshua. No, they were the Zekenim of Sefer Yehoshua.
But there were no Zekenim that sort of replaced them.
So you could say that that's a matter of dispute between the Mishnah and Avot Derabbi Natan. According to the Mishnah, it seems that the Zekenim did persist. According to the Avot Rabbi Natan, it says that no, the Zekenim were a one-time thing. That was they were the council of elders in the time of Yehoshua. And then we went on to the Shoftim. Okay, Nevi'im kiblu mei Shoftim. The Nevi'im took from the Shoftim. Shne'emar ve'eshlach aleichem kol avdi ha-Nevi'im yom hashkem u'shloach. So when were the Nevi'im operating? In this chronology,
right after the Shoftim,
who's the last Shofet and the first Navi? Shmuel and Eli, right? So you have the transition from the time of the Shoftim to the time of the Nevi'im is taking place then, right? And the Navi is somebody that's associated with the Malchut, with the Davidic dynasty. Right, Shmuel anoints the first king, and then you have other Nevi'im like Achia HaShiloni and Eliyahu, and they're interacting with the kings of Yehuda and Israel. Okay, and the last ones, so here is an interesting thing that it says, Chagai uZechariah uMalachi kiblu b'Nevi'im. Now Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi, we were used to thinking of them as Nevi'im, that they're the last of the Nevi'im. And here it's saying that no, they're, as it were, not Nevi'im, even though their books are included in the Sifrei HaNevi'im, but they're somehow, they're seen again as some sort of transitional figure, And then the Anshei Knesset HaGdola took it from Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So now you're talking about the beginning of Bayit Sheni. Okay, Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi were all alive at the beginning of Bayit Sheni. So if we're going to say, if we're going to, again, periodize, so you have Moshe, Yehoshua, the Zekeinim are right after Yehoshua, and then the Shoftim until Binyan Bayit Rishon, or the establishment of the Davidic monarchy. If you want to go with the Mishnah, that it's the Nevi'im that were until the, that it's the Zekeinim throughout that period. The Nevi'im correspond to the time where, of Bayit Rishon, where the Davidic monarchy was in power. And then at the beginning of Bayit Sheni, you have the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, or you have Chagai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and then the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. Interesting question. Before we even get to that, okay.
We know to the population, you know, if it's just the Nevi'im that we have in books,
okay,
you don't have a very, you don't have much of a basis upon.
So the question that we're, the question here is, I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference. I think what's we know very little about what Jews were doing in the time of Bayit Rishon. What we do know, we know from the archaeological record, that the Tanakh itself says very little about what Israelite religion looked like in Bayit Rishon. And the archaeological record, I mean, it's trustworthy in as much as it shows you what people were doing, but we know from reading Tanakh that there were all kinds of things that people were doing that they weren't necessarily supposed to be doing, right? Like worshiping all kinds of idols, like Asherah, which was a uniquely Jewish form of idolatry, like bringing korbanot on bamot, private altars, like shtiblach. So there were all kinds of things that were going on that weren't necessarily, meaning, is this the true Israelite religion? We don't know. It's what Jews were doing. But at the same time, there's a choice here that's going on. There's a, whoever is formulating the Mishnah is choosing to see themselves as the heir of, not of the Nevi'im, not of the Kohanim, not of the Melachim, but of the Nevi'im. Meaning they see themselves as the heirs of the Nevi'im. Okay? The Kohanim were, they were Kohanim. They also, they were running the Beit HaMikdash. But the Chachamim are seeing themselves, no, we don't see them, we don't see the Kohanim as the authentic receivers and transmitters of the Torah. We see the Nevi'im as that. Yes? Right. Right. Malachim, they were at the same time as the Nevi'im. Right? You have the Nevi'im. There were, if you want to say the power base, right? There were three sources of power. There were three sources of authority during Bayit Rishon. You had the Nevi'im, you had the Kohanim, and you had the Melachim and the Nesi'im, the aristocracy. And here it's choosing.
But wait, Malachim was the source of Malachim.
Not according to this.
The
we'll go to the, we'll get to the Rambam.
Weren't the Nevi'im the only one who were really kind of prominent, though? Like the Malachim and the, at that time were pretty.
Yeah, like, yeah. The Malachim weren't necessarily so. Okay.
Or the Kohanim at that time.
All right. It's 8:35, and we're still on the first page. So let's. Yeah, let's keep moving. Okay. The Rambam fills in the gaps here. Okay, the Rambam, if you take a look at the source number 4, okay, he first he quotes this Sifra. I have to say something about the Sifra. Sifra, 3rd century, is one of what's called the Midrashei Halacha, right? It's organized in the order of the Chumash, and it, verse by verse, pasuk by pasuk, learns what halachot are derived from that pasuk. Three main books of the Midrash Halacha. There's Mechilta on Shemot, Sifra on Vayikra, and Sifrei on Bamidbar and Devarim. And the generation after the Mishnah. So generation after the Mishnah. Yeah. And there was a certain polemic, meaning there was a lot of polemic about rabbinic halacha doesn't look like, there's a lot of things that we do that don't look like they come straight from the pasuk, right? So here you have an attempt to organize Torah Shebaal Peh according to the order of Torah Shebichtav to show how the Torah Shebaal Peh actually does emerge from Torah Shebichtav. So you have this Sifra and Bechukotai, which puts a very blunt point on that exact point. Eila achukim v'amishpatim v'hatorot asher natan Hashem beino l'vein v'nei Yisrael. And it learns from each of those things. Hachukim, that's the medrash. Hamishpatim, elo adinim, hatorot, melamed sheshtei torot nitlu lahem l'Yisrael, meaning there's an oral law that accompanies the Torah shebichtav. Asher natan Hashem beino l'vein v'nei Yisrael, zachar Moshe le'asot shliach bein Yisrael l'aviyam shebashamayim, Behar Sinai b'yad Moshe melamed shenitna Torah hilchotah v'diktukeh perusha al yedei Moshe miSinai. It was all given to Moshe at Sinai. The Midrashim and the Mishnah Brura, right, was given to Moshe as everything. All given to Moshe at Sinai. Okay, again, there's a polemical context to that, but there's different ways to understand that. Meaning, is it literally that Moshe had it all? Or are we saying that everything ultimately derives from what we got from Moshe? Okay, Rambam takes that second approach. And he quotes the Braita. And he writes, this is towards the middle of the second line, Kol haTorah k'tava Moshe Rabbeinu kodem sheyamut b'chtav yado. Moshe wrote the Torah himself, his own handwriting. He gave it to the Shvatim. And he also gave them the Torah Shebaal Peh. Look at Ot Dalet, Afal Pishalo Nechteva Torah Shebaal Peh, Limda Moshe Rabbeinu Kula Beveidino Lishizdim Zekenim. Rambam here is describing what he views as the halachic process. The Torah Shebaal Peh wasn't written down, but Moshe taught it to the Shivim Zakenim. Elazar, Pinchas, and Rabbi Yoshua, they all got it from Moshe. And they gave it further. Okay. He sees this as a closed system, as a very meticulous game of telephone, right? Zakenim Rabim Kiblu Mi Yoshua. The Kibel Eli Min HaZakenim when we Pinchas, and then he introduces Eli got it from him. Ushmuel Kibel Mi Eli Ubeitino, V'David Kibel Ushmishmuel Ubeitino, V'Achia Hashilonim Yotzei Mitzrayim Haya V'Levi Haya Ushama Mi Moshe V'Haya Katan Bimei Moshe, V'Hu Kibel Mi David Ubeitino, Eliyahu Kibel Mi Achila Achia Hashiloni Uveitino, Elisha Kibel Mi Eliyahu. Meaning, there's no gap here. The Rambam wants to give you a name, however old he was. Rambam wants to give you a name that there's no gap. Okay, and he summarizes at the end. He says, from Rav Ashi to Moshe Rabbeinu, 40 people. Right? Moshe to Yehoshua. Right, and he does it backwards. Rabbi Ashi from Rava, from Rabba, from Rav Huna, from Yochanan and Rav and Shmuel, from Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, from Rabbi Shimon, from Rabbi Gamliel, from Rabbi Shimon, from Rabbi Gamliel, from Rabbi Shimon, right? One after the other. They were Sfardi, I guess. And then...
Under Ashkenazi, it was grandsons.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
So it's Ashkenazi. Sorry, it would have been sons.
Hillel, right. And he goes all the way back to Moshe. 40 generations, 40 transmissions. So the Rambam seems to be learning the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. Right? This is essentially, like we saw with Avot Rabbi Natan, this is an expansion of the Mishnah, of the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. He sees it as each transmission, nothing changes, right? There's a direct transmission from A to B, from B to C, from C to D. There's no change going on. Okay? And that's something that's very important to the Rambam. If you look at source number 7, it's only mi shelo shama bo perush mipi anavi. It's only when they didn't know, when nobody had heard anything from a Navi, there was no direct transmission. By the way, Hanavi here means Moshe, because according to the Rambam, no other prophet can be, a prophet cannot innovate anything. It's only if you didn't know, then you start to use your intellect. Then you start to use logic and hermeneutic principles and syllogism and analogy. Using the rules that were given in themselves, given at Har Sinai. Dinim yitvarim nafla bahen machlokot. So there are some things that there was no machloket about, and there are other things that there is machloket about. So we have this Rambam model that the only time there's innovation is if nobody had heard from the prophet, nobody remembered the transmission, or somehow it got, there was no agreement. Right, the only time there was machloket is if there was no transmission. But really, there should be a transmission about everything. Really, there shouldn't be machloket. Machloket is the result of failure. There's a different way of understanding this Mishnah, and it's one that I tend to prefer. In terms of the Rambam, what we see with the Rambam is that he wants to show that as little as possible changed from one to the next, right? There's this thing called the Torah, and it goes from Moshe to Yoshua and Yoshua to... And by the time it gets to Rav Ashi, it's still pretty much the same thing, right? It's just you're passing the baton. It remains solid state. There's another way of understanding the Mishnah, and I take my cue here from Reb Tzadok HaKohen. Reb Tzadok HaKohen saw development of halacha as being much more dynamic. And I think that it resonates a lot more with me, and it's also historically a lot more compelling. Take a look at the Gemara in Temura. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Shloshet alafim halachot nishtakhu bimei avelo shel Moshe. During the 30 days... It's the student of Shmuel. 3,000 halachot were forgotten during the mourning period for Moshe. They said to Yehoshua, ask God what the answer is. Amar lehu lo b'shamayim. He said, I can't. It's closed. We're closed off. We can't be mechadesh anything by nevuah anymore. Amru lo l'Shmuel. They said to Shmuel Hanavi, Sha'al, ask God. Amar lahem, Eile ha-mitzvos, she'ena navi rashai l'chadesh davar me'ata. Nevi'im, that's not how halacha works now. That's not how we get the answers. V'matnitin tana, there's a braita that teaches, Elef u'shva me'ot kalon v'chamurin u'gzevot shavot v'diktuke sofer mishtakhu b'mei avelo shel Moshe. 1700 kal v'chomers and gzevot shavot. Now again, in the Rambam system, these were Gzerot Shavot that had been transmitted. These weren't syllogisms that people had invented. They were that Moshe taught a kal v'chomer that he received from God. It was kapalah, exactly. Nishtachu b'imei avelu shel Moshe. Amar Rabbi Abahu, but Rabbi Abahu says, afal pichein, nevertheless, hechziran Otniel ben Kenaz mitoch pilpulo. Otniel ben Kenaz, who was the first of the Shoftim, he restored all of these halachot through his intellect, through his cleverness, through his sophistication. I think that here's what I think is going on here. I think that, you know, we started off by talking about periodization. The Mishnah itself is talking about periodization. The period of Moshe is not the same as the period of Yehoshua. The period of Yehoshua is not the same as the period of the Zakenim. The period of the Zakenim is not the same as the period of the Nevi'im. Major changes happened in each of those things. What this is talking, what the Mishnah is saying, it's not only saying that this is the chain of transmission, this is how the baton was passed from one generation to the next, right? Where, and because if it wanted to do that, it would have done what the Rambam did. The Rambam gives you the list of 40 people who passed the baton. What this is doing is it's stratifying it. It's saying there was the Torah of Moshe's time, and then there was the Torah of Yehoshua's time, and then there was the Torah of the time of the Zakenim. And each one is dealing with a different reality, a different set of circumstances, where the Torah didn't just need to be transmitted, it also needed to be applied in a different way. That's Moshe is in the desert.
It's a little to Shoftim, refers to go to the Shoftim of your time.
We're talking about the Shoftim. We're talking about Otniel ben Kenaz. Yes, the idea of, you know, Yiftach bedoro, Kishmuel bedoro. But what I mean is that Moshe's leadership is in the time of the desert, right? Where there's a certain way of life. You know, they don't have to work for a living. They're getting mun. They don't have to. They're very infantile. Everything that's being provided is being provided directly by God. Time of Yehoshua, you're moving from this desert wandering to a time of conquest. And then from a time of conquest, you move toward a sedentary existence, which is the time of the Shoftim, this time of sedentary tribalism, which doesn't have any unity. And then when you get to the Nevi'im, you're already talking about a time of a unified kingdom or kingdoms, right? And in each one of those realities, each one of those situations requires a different sort of application of the Torah. The way that you apply the Torah in the desert is not the same as the way that you apply the Torah when you have to fight a war. And the way that you apply the Torah when you're fighting a war is not the same as the way that you apply the Torah when you're, when you're trying to create a subsistence economy or whatever it is. Okay? There's another Gemara that I really, really like in this context. And that's the Gemara in Brachot, Daf Memchet Amud Bet, which is very reminiscent of the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, in that it has this, you know, some of the names are the same, and some of the, and the progression seems to be the same. Rav Nachman says, we have four brachos in benching, right? We have Birkat HaZan, Birkat HaAretz, Bonei Yerushalayim, and Hatov HaMetiv. So Reb Nachman says that Moshe was mitakein the first bracha when the mun came down. Okay, the first bracha, if you look at it, it talks about how God sustains everyone directly. This is written at a time when it says b'sha'ashi arad lahem mun. There was no time in human history where human beings were more directly nourished by God than when the Israelites in the desert were receiving the man. That's the paradigmatic Hazan et hakol. Okay. Yehoshua tikein, right? Yehoshua was mitakein. Okay, now we have to expand that. We don't get the food directly anymore. We have to cultivate the food. And in order to cultivate the food, we have to have a land. So we're thanking God for the land which produces the food. So you have to add another layer onto benching. Now there's a medrash in Bamidbar Rabbah, which is much later. Bamidbar Rabbah was compiled in like the 1200s, where it seems to suggest that each bracha replaced the other one. That in the time of Moshe, they just said Birkat Hazan. And in the time of Yoshua, they just said Birkat Haaretz, which is a pretty radical understanding of what's going on here. But it shows that, you know, you have this evolving relationship. What are you thanking God for? What do we bench? What are we benching for? What are we blessing God for? In the time of Moshe, we're thanking God for the food, because that's what we're getting from God. In the time of Yoshua, we're thanking God for the land, because that's what we're getting from God, and from it, we're cultivating the food. By the time you get to Yerushalayim, when you get to David and Shlomo, Bonei Yerushalayim, you're not just talking about an agrarian economy anymore, you're talking about a civilization. This is the pinnacle of Jewish civilization. Right? We have a temple, and we have a capital, right? And this is the peak of Jewish influence. And he's developing trade routes, and he's developing, you know, there's real wealth. You're not talking about subsistence anymore. And that's what Yerushalayim represents. And when we're thanking God in that bracha, we're thanking God, it's a different level than the level of, you know, it's a higher level. It's a more comprehensive level than the level of subsistence. And then you get to the fourth bracha, which is the bracha of breakdown, the bracha of rupture, right? When was that mitukan? That was Biyavne Tiknua Keneged Harugei Beitar. That was instituted in the aftermath of the failed Bar Kokhba rebellion, meaning this was the last stand. This was the last hurrah of any sort of Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael, any sort of Jewish aspiration for sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael for 1800 years, from about 135 until the 1900s, right? And if you think about the bracha, it's an extremely, I'm going to use a word that I hate, galuti bracha. It's a bracha that talks about exile. What are we thanking God for? Hatov hametiv. Right? What's the hatov that... Hatov shalohi srichu. God is good. Where's God's goodness here? The bodies didn't decompose. The bodies that were left in the citadel of Beitar. Hatov hametiv. Hakel avinu malkeinu adreinu boreinu goaleinu adreinu gurus. Hamelech hatov v'hametiv lakol shebuchol yom v'yom hu hetiv v'metiv hu yetiv lanu. Yeah. Hatov shelo yisrichu. The bodies weren't allowed to decompose. That God miraculously prevented the bodies from decomposed. The hametiv shenitnu lekvura. And metiv, that God influenced the Roman governors to allow the bodies to be buried. Right? So this is a very dramatic, and by the way, lahalocha, there's one word that signifies this rupture. Right? We're going from the first bracha to the second bracha to the third bracha. There's almost like a crescendo. And then that third bracha, we actually, it's the only, for Ashkenazim, it's the only bracha that we say amen to our own bracha. Now, Sfardim, whenever there's a bracha at the end of a series of brachos, they say amen, right? Shomer Amo Yisrael La'ad amen, right? For example. But Ashkenazim, this is the only time that we say, and even for Sfardim, it's irregular here because it looks like you have a series of four brachos, but you don't. The third one, it breaks. There's a break, there's a rupture. The fourth bracha is completely separate, okay? So looking at that, looking at how the Gemara is thinking about benching, Birkat HaMazon, right? Applying it to the first Mishnah in Avot, I think that you have a different model. It's not necessarily the opposite of the Rambam, but it complements the Rambam. That on one hand, if the Rambam is emphasizing the continuity, right? That there's a baton that's being passed from one to the next, without change. Here, saying that no, the situation is constantly changing. There's the situation of Moshe, there's the situation of Yoshua, there's the situation of Bayit Rishon, and then there's the situation of Galut. And all of these things require a different relationship with God and a different relationship with Torah.
I'm confused. When we talk about the primacy of the Mosaic tradition, they both acknowledge that. So even the Rambam says, actually probably it's the reverse, because the Rambam says if it doesn't start with Moshe, and if it didn't come from Moshe, and he acknowledges Mar Tzmura where it got forgotten, he doesn't see picked up with Yeshua. Hey, if Yeshua started something, it's okay.
No.
He actually focuses on the promise if you lost it. As opposed to the Gemara Torah, which may say, they asked Amar Shmuel Shal. If Shmuel made up something, we all acknowledge it became in his Nebuah. The Rambam said, no, it doesn't come from the Mosaic tradition. So your theory of that the Rambam says, oh no, there's one, but then you have only one. It all comes from Moshe, and there's only one. As for the other ones, where it's a layer, so it's the opposite. The Rambam doesn't hold that, oh, they're all, everyone has it, plays a role. It's only Moshe, and the only way we get it right is if, because we have this sequence process.
So that's what I'm saying.
It's all wrong.
Right. I'm agreeing that Rambam is emphasizing the continuity, that it all has to come from Moshe, that Rav Ashi has to be a direct line to Moshe. There can't be anything else that is coming. What I'm saying is that there's another way to look at this, not that it doesn't all come from Moshe, but that there are also discontinuities here, meaning there are seams where there are forks in the road, where Chazal of that generation had to say that, okay, we need to apply the Torah to a new set of circumstances now.
Yeah,
we're not living in the same world, we're not living in the same way, so we have to interpret Moshe's Torah, and it's going to look a little bit different, feel a little bit different. Maybe there were alternatives, maybe there are different ways to understand it.
Once you're in a vacuum and everyone would agree, we don't have that.
No, I'm not saying that there's a disagreement. I'm saying that they're complementary. No, I'm saying that they're complementary. I'm saying that they're emphasizing different aspects of it. Yeah.
But it's not only because we live in a different world. It's also because we forgot 3,000, 1,700.
Okay. So that's what I think we're talking about when we're talking about forgetting. Right? We talk about Yeridat HaDorot, right? That every subsequent generation is supposedly lesser than the generation before it. What I think that that means, and what I think that this forgetfulness is that there's one Gemara, and I can't remember offhand where it is, talks about the reason that Machloket developed was because the students of Hillel and Shammai lo shimshu kol tzorkan, right? That they didn't serve their rabbis as much as they should. Okay, now I would translate the word shimshu as they didn't apprentice sufficiently. Okay, that the way that you absorb Torah is through apprenticeship. So I think that what's going on when we talk about and failure to apprentice is what leads to failure of apprenticeship is what leads to forgetfulness. What I think forgetfulness here means is that there's a certain distance that sort of like what I was describing before about what we feel about the world before the Holocaust, that we've sort of forgotten that world. Because we haven't lived it. Meaning there were certain things that were intuitive and were natural and were spontaneous to the people that grew up in that world and lived in that world. But for us, they're no longer spontaneous. They're no longer something that we can just something that we just take for granted. And I think that that's what we call, in that sense, we've forgotten that generation. I think that when we talk, when the Gemara here talks about shikha, that these certain things were forgotten, I think that with the death of Moshe created, it was a major event. It was a major distressing event, and the way that the Gemara is describing the results of that trauma is forgetting. Meaning, we were used to a certain thing, and you even see by the way that the people are asking. Like we had Moshe, where if we ever had a question, we just asked Moshe, and Moshe like had the hotline to God. And you see that the people are asking Yehoshua, "What? Just ask God." And they're asking Shmuel, ask God. Why can't you just ask God? And they're saying, no, it's changed. We don't figure it out by asking God anymore. Now we have to figure it out through pilpul. I think that's the process of, you know, to use Chaim Soloveitchik's term, rupture and reconstruction, right? There's a rupture, there's a break, there's a forgetting. And we have to sort of compensate for that by using intellect, right? Which is why at the same time that you have your Yeridat HaDorot, you also have thinking about Torah gets more sophisticated with every generation. Because our sophistication, our intellectual sophistication, is compensating for this.
Just on that point, too, when Professor Elton describes Rasadak, so he disagrees. He says that according to the Rambam, Moshe was the ideal. He takes the idea that Rasadak says that Akiva, when he didn't understand, or Moshe comes, the Midrash says, the Gemara says that Moshe came and didn't understand what the Tag is trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
Describing. What does that mean? Moshe had one Torah. He had never failed. Akiva, who came from a failed background, which is in essence what they said. Tzedek actually said that explicitly. So that there are two different, completely different methodologies. The Rambam says Moshe has one and it was singular. Rabbi Tzedek, it is what you're saying, there wasn't an ideal that of Torah Moshe, and everything else is trying to guess and understand it. There are other Torahs that exist, so much so that he uses that as an exemplar of it. But,
right. I mean, I'm trying to harmonize, but I think that the Rambam does. Well, whatever. There'll be more to say about the Rambam. I want this to... okay, well, that's...